Melissa got me on meditation, and I commit 11 minutes to my mental health every day, which is nothing. I mean, what is 11 minutes? And sometimes the meditation sessions suck and I'm thinking about everything, but most days I'm focused and it helps reel me in. It changed my life.
Hello and welcome to episode 104 of the Mad Happy Podcast. This is Phineas. On today's episode, we have Payman's conversation with Simon Huck. Simon is a longtime public relations and marketing executive as well as an entrepreneur. He's had his hands in many, many different projects as well as companies that he himself has built. Simon talks about his motivation to move to New York to pursue a career in the PR industry, the mental health realities that come with moving to such a big city with very limited resources or connections. They talk about the importance of taking risks, finding balance, entrepreneurship. It's a wide-ranging conversation. So without further ado, the Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism. Enjoy the show with Payman and Simon Huck.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Mad Happy Podcast. I'm Payman, and today we are joined by Simon Huck. Simon, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It is a pleasure to be on.
Yeah, so we were just talking off air about, I was trying to do this for a couple of weeks, and I remember a couple of weeks ago as I was just like preparing for the episode, trying to think through like, wow, like you've had such an interesting background and just like how you got to where you are today. I'd love to like take it back a little bit to the beginning. I know that you were born in Canada, but I guess early years, upbringing, anything that you really remember from that time that you think made an impact on who you are today?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like I have like a flurry of memories that I think from a very early age was almost like the North Star for things that I was really passionate about. Like from, I would say like 10 on, I was obsessed with pop culture. I don't even know if we called it pop culture back then. Maybe we did. But I would have like viewing parties of the Grammys and the Oscars and the Golden Globes. And I would have friends over. And I remember like other 10 and 11 year olds were like not as enthralled by like watching the Oscars. It was like something you typically would watch with your parents. But I was enamored with celebrity and entertainment. And growing up in Ottawa, there was no proximity to anything in entertainment at all. So it felt like another world, but it was always something that kept me like, just, I was like a fanatic. I was obsessed.
Yeah. And was that mainly kind of, I mean, the only thing I know about Ottawa is that Shopify was started there,
yeah.
But is there anything that like, I guess when you were growing up, was it all like kind of more like US pop culture for the most part?
Totally.
And just like being super into that?
It was US pop culture, and I had subscriptions to People Magazine and Us Magazine. And I had those subscriptions since I was like, 12 or 13. And then I went to college at this school called Queen's University, which is, I mean, if there was any Queen's alumni listening, I think they would consider it to be a very academic, serious school. And so I had this talk track where I would tell people like, I'm doing a political science major and then I'm going to go to law school. But I never believed that was my real, that was not my path. But you kind of just get into this automated response of, this is what I'm here for. You know, everyone here wants to be a lawyer. Like, it just felt like that was kind of my spiel. And then my subscription to Us Weekly stayed with me in college. I was like the crazy person that would have it arrive in the dorms like every Wednesday. And I was reading an article about a woman named Lizzie Grubman. And Lizzie had been involved in a kind of an infamous car accident. And she was this, what they called a power publicist. So she had some of the biggest clients in New York and LA. And they called her a PR princess. And long story short, she ended up in jail. She got out of jail after her infamous car accident. Got a show on MTV Power Girls. And that is where I found, her in her journey in this Us Weekly article. And I was hypnotized. I thought, how am I going to work for this woman? And I was finishing my last year of college. And so I called her office in New York. I had never been in New York before. I called every single day and I said, I left messages. I spoke to random interns. I said, I'll do whatever it takes, but I'm willing to work for free if you will at least have the, you know, give me the break that I need to at least meet you guys, take an interview, do whatever. So finally, someone calls me back and says, if you ever happen to be in New York, we'll take a meeting with you. So I called my parents, said I got a job interview. That's like the beginning of the lie. Flew to New York and walked in the very next day. And I think that everyone there was like, who is this stranger? What is he doing here? The CFO at the time didn't even remember having the conversation with me.
And so I guess, one, you said you were lying to your parents. Was that because you were worried, like they didn't kind of support the path? Or what was like that relationship like, I guess, at the time?
Well, it's a, so let's like take it back a little bit. So 2004, 2005, back then, everyone who was going to college, like sociology and psychology, like if you were going to do a Bachelor of Arts degree, you were doing something there, or at least you were thinking that you were starting there. But PR communications at the time did not feel like a serious field. And it didn't feel like a field where there was really going to be huge opportunity for me, especially since I had no connection to New York. I didn't even know what PR meant. I thought PR was like event planning. I thought that I would be like throwing a dinner party. I had no idea. You know, now that I have spent, you know, years in marketing and PR, it's just such a vast field. But the day that I walked into Lizzie's office, she was partners with this guy named Jonathan Cheban, who now goes by the name of Food God. That's a whole other story. And he kind of looked at me and said, oh, you should work here. And Lizzie was like, yeah, work here. We won't pay you. It will be 2 days a week. But if you want to start next week, you know, you have a place and you can get coffee here. So I had a friend that lived in New York at the time, and she said I could sleep on her sofa. And that was the beginning of an internship that changed the trajectory of my life forever. I ended up working for them kind of as an unpaid intern for almost a year. And I then got a job working for Jonathan a year after that. And then the rest is history.
Where are your parents in the mix with this as it's happening?
Oh, they thought I had lost it. So my whole strategy was increments. So I would say I'm only here for 6 weeks. So I need to borrow just enough money to survive for 6 weeks. And I wasn't eating at restaurants. I was like living the most frugal of lifestyle. Like I was just kind of getting by. I would walk everywhere. And honestly, I was so excited. I didn't care. I was working all of these red carpet events. I couldn't believe that this was a career. I couldn't believe that you could do this for a living. And so every 6 weeks, my parents would call and say, okay, it's time to come home. You know, you're an unpaid intern. Like the gig is up. And I'd say, okay, well, they actually said that if I do another 3 weeks, they'll consider. And like, they were not saying anything. They were not hiring me. I had no experience. I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was like deeply insecure working in New York, being an intern in New York. I had, you know, everything was intimidating. I remember the first week, they took me to Nobu, and I had like read about Nobu in like tabloids, and like I had seen paparazzi pictures of celebrity, and I was like, what the hell am I going to do at Nobu? And God forbid the check comes at Nobu. Like I'm not eating a thing. Like I am starving at Nobu in fear that I'm going to have to pick up this bill. Like there are all these memories you have when I first moved that were so scary. And I kept saying, okay, well, I'm just going to do this for a little bit longer. Then I'm going to go back. And it was always the fallback plan. Like I could go to grad school, I could go to law school, but it was never what I wanted.
Yeah. And I guess like identity wise, like you said you were like so like nervous to be in New York, obviously, which makes sense. Like coming from Ottawa, your first time in New York, it's like the opposite kind of city. But did you feel like you were on the right path? And it was just like you just knew that you just like had to try your best and see what happened? Or like were you like, maybe this isn't even for me. Like, I don't even know what's like going on.
Yes. So it's a little bit of A and B. Like throughout the day, I loved what I was doing and I loved the events that we were doing. And essentially Lizzie and Jonathan had a company that secured media for red carpet events. They brought celebrities to events. Like the term wrangling. They would wrangle talent. So influencers, industry executives, I mean, the word influencer didn't even exist back then, but there was kind of this pocket of people that were really important that would go to movie premieres, that would go to the opening of a restaurant. Nightlife was a huge industry. I mean, it's since changed a lot, but back then celebrities were going to nightclubs all the time. So there was Bungalow 8. I don't know how old you are. I'm a grandfather, but
I'm 29.
These nightclubs were like big things, and Lizzie and Jonathan represented all of these crazy places. And so I loved what I was doing, but then I would meet people and they, not that they were unkind to me, but I felt almost like the first several years that I lived in New York that I was almost invisible in some of these circles.
Yeah.
Like in entertainment, it's like, oh, you're this random person from Canada. You know, you don't have this like family connection. You don't have this network of people. Like, I don't know really, you know, I don't really see any value in you. And so that complex develops very early on where you're like, what the F am I doing here? Like, I don't think I'm ever going to be taken seriously. And I think that as I grew my career was really a passion. It kind of propelled my passion. I was like, no, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to be the best at PR, in this case, entertainment PR, so I can kind of prove myself. It was driving me in the end.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think like very similar. I moved to LA when I was 6, didn't speak English, obviously. So like my parents immigrated, all this stuff. And I always had this sort of like chip on my shoulder, like I'm different than everyone else and I'm the outsider. So like I have to try really hard in school and then I have to work really hard here and then blah, blah, blah. And I want everyone to like me, all these things. I guess it's like there's so many good sides to that, obviously. And it like propelled you. And then obviously there's the other side, which is like, why am I actually doing these things? Like, why do I keep telling myself like I'm not good enough? Like, what was that dialogue with yourself as you were growing up?
I think the dialogue, you know, it gets better as you get more comfortable in the field you're in. But then as my career has pivoted multiple times over the last 17 years, when I went to go launch a startup, when I went to go fundraise for the first time, like you go back to the same feeling you had when you were 18 years old. I'm like, oh God, I'm back to feeling like I'm the intern again. And, you know, it's that cliche thing where you're supposed to be uncomfortable and you really are. Like the greatest things in my life came from moments where I was the most uncomfortable. And I say this to my husband all the time, like the 18-year-old who had 17 cents in his bank account, who flew to New York on like Air Miles and stayed on a friend's sofa and got this internship that really didn't look like it had any future. Like, that was like such a courageous move. And I'm, you know, now like 18 years later, I'm like, wait, where is that Simon? Like, where the hell did he go? Like, I am literally worried about everything. I'm worried about like, will I make my, like, I worry about every possible detail of my day. And then I go back to like, well, the 18-year-old was like a superhero. So like, how do I double click and channel that person?
Yeah. I think it's crazy also to look at like, how similar you still are to the past in thinking. And obviously over time, you hopefully get better and you work through a lot of the stuff that maybe held you back in some ways. I guess for you, like your career has, like you said, been in so many different areas. Like I think someone looking at your career would be like, wow, like, you know, like everything this guy's done is like worked out so well. Like, you know, it's so easy to connect all the dots, like looking back. But I guess like, as you were progressing, like what were some of those like next steps and like failures along the way to like eventually like Simon today?
Yeah. Oh no, we don't have a long enough podcast to go over the failure rate of all the things that just didn't work. And it's like unfortunate because I feel like there needs to be a separate social media app that just focuses on like the things that didn't work. Cause those are the, I think arguably those are the ones that are the most interesting. I had wanted to start businesses kind of throughout my 20s. I, you know, having worked in marketing, worked in PR, I was really, really good at making brands, things, in some cases, even people famous. I knew the secret sauce. I knew what it took. I knew how to kind of light that match. And so I had been really successful in making some small brands pop. And I thought, wait a minute, I can do this for myself. And I can't tell you how many notepads I filled out, how many business plans I did, and then just never took that next step. Never kept the idea in that baby stage and didn't talk to people about it, didn't take that weird, uncomfortable meeting where you're asking someone you barely know for help. Like all the things you need to do when you start something new. I think in my 20s, I kept saying, I'm not ready yet. I don't sound like I know what I'm talking about yet. Let me become, you know, and you go back and you could regret it, but I don't regret it. Cause then in my 30s, I said, okay, actually I'm ready to fail and I'm ready to try things. And I'm going to take that coffee meeting. I'm going to take actually 100 coffee meetings until I find a person who can help build my business model, till I find a co-founder for the business I want to launch. And so the path has been just like this, up and down, yeah, and sideways, like everyone else who's in it.
Yeah, I love the podcast for failures idea, because I think it's like so easy to think that like anyone who's now successful or has some sort of success, it was just like they were destined for it and like no one else is. And like you're in this spot where like there's like a kid in Ottawa that's like, yeah, but that was like 20 years ago. That's why he was able to do that. Like, I can't do that today or something like that. And then one more thing on what you just said around just believing in yourself. I think as I've gotten older, it's kind of like you see that like everyone else, like, they're just taking the next step. And like, whether you're like 15, 25 or 35, like you could take that same exact step. And it's not like, cause you're older, now you're like wiser necessarily. And it's like learning that and like sharing that, I think, is like super important.
100%. I think you just, and I think some of the, like the younger generation that I speak to, like they definitely have the tenacity to ask. But then it's like, are you willing to put in the work and the sacrifice to do it? And it is sacrifice. Like I think of the first, like I moved here when I was 20. So the first 7 years of my life, like in New York, I didn't have a social life outside of work. Like that was just not it. Like I wasn't dating anyone. I didn't really have any like significant friendship. Like it was all work. And I loved it and I don't regret it, but I didn't have that typical 20 to 27 year old experience living in the city.
Yeah. I think what you also said is like, it's never been easier to make the ask, which is obviously why, like, I think the younger generation and even me, like for me, it was like so much easier than 15 years ago. Cause like you couldn't get in contact with someone.
Right.
But just cause the ask is easier, I think like the effort still has to be there within the ask. Right.
It's yes.
Like, there's a big difference between like someone being like, Simon, like, can I get coffee with you? Or here's this like hour I spent on this thing, which I think you should be looking a look at, you know, and there's like this quality difference is so important. And then I think knowing just how long it takes, like you just said, I mean, we've been working on Mad Happy for the last 6 years, just like nonstop. And it's just the beginning. And at first when I was younger, I was like, oh, like 5 years is a long time to work on a company. Now I'm like, you could work on a company for 30 years and still feel like there's more to do. So I love that advice.
Yeah, no, it's such a journey. But if you love it, again, cliche, annoying, eye roll, but if you really love it, it doesn't feel like a job.
For sure. And what was like for you, like the next sort of like moving to New York was like that first spark. Mm-hmm. And obviously a bunch of stuff happens in between, but like, where did you feel like, okay, like, maybe now you're in your 30s, like what was that next thing that happened, that right meeting or whatever that led to the next part of your life?
So I knew that I wanted to launch a business. I knew that I had been making other businesses famous through marketing and PR and influencer and celebrity relationships. And I thought, okay, well, what can I do that I'm really passionate about? And I had friends and family who had been involved in hurricanes, a tropical storm. I have friends and family that live in Florida. I have two friends who lost their homes in Southern California in wildfires. And so I had this moment with another good friend of mine, who's now my co-founder at a business called Judy. We couldn't understand why there was no market for emergency preparedness for families across the U.S. Anything you were buying felt like really low quality, or it was the American Red Cross. Wasn't organized, it wasn't curated, there was no brand around emergency preparedness. So we thought my background, my network with celebrity and influencer could really help propel this mission forward. And so in January 2020, we launched Judy, which is exactly that. It's an emergency preparedness brand. And then 3 months later, COVID hit, which is, and we've been working on Judy for 2.5 years. So the timing was crazy. By March 27th, we had sold out of every single Judy that we had manufactured, and we were essentially sold out for 7 months.
So is that like the first example of like you sort of took that next step, started your first thing that was like, here's a brand that yeah. like is mine, versus like you got so good at like helping other brands with your own time and relationships, but this is like, here's something that I actually own.
Here's something that I own. Here's something that I'm going to raise capital for. Here's something that I'm going to have coffee with every single person in my phone book and talk about, which is what you really need to do. Like when you birth one of these businesses, and you know, with Mad Happy, it's like you have actually spoken to every single person in your phone book, and you're taking calls and Zooms and coffee chats with people that may be helpful and may not be helpful, but you're willing to do whatever it takes to take your business to the next level. And I felt I had that passion towards this category and this brand. And so this was like kind of the next evolution. And then simultaneously, I was in a relationship with now my husband, and he was extremely passionate about fragrance. And same thing, like he was like, oh, but I'll never be able to raise the money, or, oh, like, how will I do this? Like, I have no experience in fine fragrance, and who will manufacture it? How will I even, you know, it's like entrepreneurship. Like yeah. you think of,
it's easy to make that list.
Yeah. yeah. It's so hard to get it going. And so Phil then launched that business 8 months after Judy launched. I guess you would call me like a strategic advisor to Sniff. I'm involved in a lot of their celebrity partnerships, and obviously he's my husband, so I'm like, you know, deeply passionate and supportive of everything he does. But so that was kind of the next one. And then currently, and this is kind of like a non sequitur, but I can touch on, I met the girls, the Kardashians. I met Kim. Khloe and I were personal assistants together way back in the day, in 2006 or seven. Kim and I met through a mutual friend before she was on her show. And so we've always had an incredible relationship. We've done several business deals together, but never formally. They're managed by their mom. But I am a talent buyer. So my marketing company brings brand deals to celebrities and influencers on behalf of the brand. So not only did I have a personal relationship, but I'd also done a ton of deals with them. And Courtney, for years, has been incredibly passionate about health and wellness. It's what propelled her to launch Poosh in 2018, which is her multimedia site. And she kept saying, like, I love gummy vitamins, but I hate the ingredients in them. And I feel like there's a better way to do it. And Courtney had the opportunity to launch it with so many different partners. And in the end, a couple of years ago, she said, you know what? I want to do it with a team that I build from the ground up. And I've been her business partner, and we launched the brand in September, and we've been working on it for over 3 years.
Wow. That's awesome. And definitely want to come back to that. One question is like, when you're starting Judy, and I have a set, so that's great. But when you're starting, like, was it like a weird change for you, you know, to be like the buyer of talent for other brands, but then now having to change those relationships and be like, hey, like, this is actually for me, you know, and it's like for something I'm creating. Like, you're so used to the opposite side. Like, how is that?
Totally. Like being on the other side. Yes and no. So with Judy, it was such a no-brainer, because the emergency preparedness space, if you're a mom, let's say you're a celebrity mom, any mom, but let's just talk celebrity, and you are living in the California area, and you've been evacuated from your home, and you live in Montecito, and there's been mudslides. When you get a kit that's going to bring your family together, that's focused on preparing you for life's unexpected emergencies, it's kind of a call to arms. And I never felt, and with Judy, like, we never felt like we needed to do anything in terms of compensating talent. Like, our product really spoke for itself. Celebrities, influencers bought our product. Sometimes we seeded the product when it made sense, but most people were so thrilled to have a product that fit the need. And when it comes to emergencies, it's so scary. It's if you've got kids who are below the age of 10, you're terrified of losing the power. You're terrified of losing contact with emergency services. Like, and you know, the trend lines, unfortunately, are only getting worse. Storms are getting bigger and more intense, and people are less prepared than they've ever been. They're so we're so reliant on our phones. So it was a very easy, it was an easy transition for me.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I guess like now when you're talking about like working on all these brands, still running the other businesses that you've started in the past, like was there a moment, I'm sure there's been many moments, but it's like, you know, most people we interview on the show, it's like, at some point it's like too much.
Yes.
And like something has to change and something has to, you have to like reframe or like hit a low to like change this next part of your life. Any good examples of that for you?
Yes. So for me, and maybe this will resonate for people, and I think it was the same for my husband, like with Judy, I knew what I was really, really good at. And I also knew what I was not nearly qualified for. So finding a co-founder that had all of the operational skills, had all of the financial modeling, had all of the things that I was not comfortable with, and being a superstar at that, like I knew that finding that marriage was imperative. Like I'll never be, I can say this right, like very confidently, I'll never be a single founder. I'll always want to do it with a co-founder. I think that starting a business can be extremely lonely. I speak to my co-founders 56 times a day. We like second guess our decisions in the best way. And to do it alone, like when I meet a single founder, I'm like, wow, you're a hero. Who do you call? Like, who are you buzzing with all day? So that was kind of a no-brainer for me. And with my marketing business Command, I had someone who had worked at the business for, you know, 11 years, 12 years. And as I started to go scale other businesses, I knew that he would step in and act as a true partner.
And I guess for you, like, what have you found, I mean, life-wise, to like keep that balance within yourself when you know that you're always going to be like ambitious and working hard and trying to like push forward and build more great businesses, do more great things, like the balance of like mentally feeling good, physically feeling good, and like the line between those?
Yes. So it has been a journey. It has been a journey. I'll say that I, going into Judy, I had major sleep issues. I've always been a bad sleeper. And I guess at the time I would chalk it up to just, you know, not having good sleep hygiene. What I didn't realize was that I was an anxious person that didn't like acknowledge that my anxiety is what was keeping me up. So it wasn't actually that sleep was the issue, it was anxiety. So I have a very dear friend who actually married Phil and I. Her name is Melissa Wood. She has an incredible platform where she motivates and inspires people to meditate, to work out, to do any sort of like kind of health and wellness things that make you feel good. And I always thought that was a little bit like, I don't know, not me. I was like, oh, is that stuff actually work? Melissa got me on meditation and it changed my life. I commit 11 minutes to my mental health every day, which is nothing. I mean, what is 11 minutes? And sometimes the meditation sessions suck and I'm thinking about everything, but most days I'm focused and it helps reel me in. And it's the first thing I do in the morning. And I started it just before I launched Judy, and it has been a complete game changer. I also read a book called The Sleep Solution by this guy named Chris Winter. Game-changing book. Changed my relationship to sleep. I have recommended this book to hundreds of people who have reached out to me and said, this book changed my life. I took 20 pages of notes from reading the book. And I took those notes and I studied them and it changed my relationship to sleep.
Wow. That's sick. I got to check that out. How do you now thinking about, you know, a newer business like Lemmy and what you guys are trying to do there? Of course, like it's a long road. Of course, you guys have a great team and everything. How are you thinking about where you want to take that business? Like you said, and we have a bunch of it in the office. So thank you for sending, but.
Oh my God, of course.
How are you thinking about like, what is it that you guys are trying to build and how it layers into like what you're passionate about as well?
Yeah, I mean, for Courtney, her passion for health and wellness, you know, it's been since she was really young. And she started trying gummy vitamins years ago. And I think a lot of people, certainly me, like I was not a capsule person. And I definitely knew I had deficiencies in my diet, but I wanted a treat. And all of the vitamins that were out there had really shitty ingredients. 80% of the gummy vitamins you're seeing on the market have corn syrup. They use gelatin, artificial colors. I mean, they have ingredients that you would not want to put in your body, and they're coupling them with vitamins. So we set out on this mission, and Courtney is methodical, to figure out a way to create a gummy that is using clinically studied ingredients, that's good for you, that has clinical results. So it was hard. And it tastes like candy. The goal was you want it to taste like candy. You want the treat. So it was a 4-year journey, and it was hundreds and hundreds of samples and formulators and doctors and a medical board. Like, it was the full thing. And being on that journey and then launching it with someone who's I'm incredibly close with has been so gratifying. And then, of course, unlike Judy, like Courtney's our founder. She is one of the most followed people in the world. All of her sisters have grown massive businesses through their reach. It's also really exciting because you can, if done right and the product is right, you can reach a lot of people very quickly and you can scale really quickly. So that's been really exciting. And we're going into retail in 8 days. We're going to be in Ulta nationwide. And then we're just going to keep going. We're launching new formats in the next 6 weeks. We've had product launches every 6 to 8 weeks. And she is involved in every piece of the business. Like, she's hand drawing the logos. She's on every Zoom call. A day before her wedding, she's doing sampling on each gummy. I mean, this is her baby.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think a lot of people forget about the product side of just like, oh, it's a brand that has a celebrity involved, so like the product doesn't matter. But I think any brand that lasts, the product is still at the core. And yes, maybe someone learned about the brand because of the name, but then they stick with it because of how good the product is.
Oh yeah. And I just, in my other business, I have so many examples, which I'll be kind and not share, of celebrities who've launched businesses that thought, oh wow, George Clooney sold his tequila for $700 million. Kylie sold her business. Like, we can just launch something, attach my name to it. Unless you are obsessed, unless you are just like any other founder, the business won't grow. Like, the consumer is so savvy. Like, they're just so with it. They know everything. They're researching your ingredients. They want to know where you're manufacturing. They want to know. The transparency now is critical, and the customer's demanding it.
Yeah, for sure. And what about for you starting a business with someone that you're friends with? I mean, there's challenges with that, of course, too, right?
Totally. It was something that I was nervous about on the onset, but because we've worked together and had this relationship for 20 years, and it has been like just an incredible experience. I think Courtney kind of understands the things that, from a marketing perspective, that are really important. And then I know the things that for Courtney that, you know, the details that really matter and things that she's just like, for example, sustainability, like all of our bottles are 100% post-consumer recycled materials. From a business perspective, that's very expensive. We offset all of our shipments, business perspective, very expensive. And for Courtney, it was table stakes. You know, she said, listen, I don't care what the market's doing. In order for me to talk about this product and believe in this, like, everything needs to be at a standard that I am proud of. And I think if Courtney had other business partners, they may say, oh, but that's not what the market, that's not what we're seeing in the market. And I think that friction with Courtney just wouldn't work.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I guess thinking back as we wrap up, like giving advice back to like the 18-year-old version of yourself or the 18-year-old version that's similar to you now, in a small city around the world, like what would that be? You know, because like, you know how you felt back then of just like so unsure of yourself, of the future, of what was going to happen, where you would fit in, like how you would learn about yourself. What would you say?
I And I know some people don't believe in regrets, but I still have them. I regret all those business plans I told you about, some of which were great ideas. I regret that I didn't take them to the next level. And I think the biggest thing I see, certainly with friends who are in their 30s, is that they have these incredible ideas in their 20s. And when you're in your 20s and you're starting out, you can afford to make less money. But the golden handcuffs that come when you've worked in finance or you've worked in wherever and you're making a certain amount of money a year, and then you're going to go into entrepreneurship when you're 35 and you're like, shit, I have this lifestyle that I'm used to. I'm going to have to give it up for the next 5 years with no guarantee that there'll ever be an exit. So I would encourage myself to start failing, trying things as soon as possible, because it's the best time to start.
Yeah, I agree. And we always say that it's just like starting when the younger you are, when you start, just even if you fail, the amount you'll learn from that is like far outpaces any job that you would have in that time.
100%.
And you could always get a normal job. You know, I think you could always go back and figure that out. I think
totally.
There's so many people that live with that regret forever of never taking that chance. And I think it's sad if you're meant and you really want to do something to not let yourself.
Right. And find a co-founder. If you're nervous about things you don't know, find a co-founder. Take 100 coffees until you find a person that shares like your values and shares the passion for what you want to build, and go do it.
Yeah. And I think confidence builds over time. I think knowing that like just taking one step is all you need to do today, not know everything, not figure everything out, not know like what it's going to look like in 10 years. I think that also stops. Two final questions we ask everyone. One is just like anyone that you've been inspired by. I mean, you shared some of them already, but that you think should tell their story on the Mad Happy podcast.
I mean, I'm just going to say my founder, Courtney Kardashian Barker, because I've just chatted about our business together because I think her story is really interesting.
Yeah. Awesome. That's a great one. And final question is, Simon, what makes you mad happy?
Recently, product launches. Every time we have a product launch, I'm mad happy.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Amazing conversation. Greatly appreciate the time. I know everyone's going to love the episode. Where can people find everything you're up to, everything you guys are up to at Lemmy?
Our Instagram is at Lemmy, and our website is lemmylive.com.
That's a great URL. I love that. Thank you so much. And signing off, everyone. Peace.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Mad Happy Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Please tune in next week for another conversation, and have a wonderful weekend. Take care.
The Mad Happy Podcast is brought to you by Optimism.